Good afternoon. You're listening to Praxis here on KYRS, Thinner Community Radio. I am here in the studio doing a live interview with someone I've recently met who is a volunteer with Christian Peacemaker Teams, an organization who's been doing work for decades around the world. But where I first heard of their work was in Palestine, in the occupied West Bank, and met some folks who did that work when I was there, and I was really focusing on a lot of Israel-Palestine activism, and really happy to have him in the studio. So hi, thanks for joining me. Do you want to give a better description of what CPT is and does than I just did, just to kick it off?
It's a perfect intro to it. So Christian Peacemaker Team, CPT, is an international organization that works to build partnerships with communities that are experiencing violence. And we're invited to do our work of witness, always at the invitation of a community. And our current programs right now are in places such as Colombia, Iraqi Kurdistan, Lesbos, Greece, and in Palestine, where we've been there since 1995.
Nice. And so you've recently returned from a second kind of time stint with CPT in Al-Khalil. Mm-hmm. Is that correct?
Yes.
And I guess maybe we should back up to you. So what inspired you to do that kind of work in the first place? What's your entry point into international solidarity work in Palestine specifically?
Yeah. I grew up learning about U.S. imperialism and the effect it had on countries across the world, but specifically places in Central America, South America, and in the Middle East. And I was especially moved and bereaved to hear the story of Palestinians and to hear the ways that State of Israel's military occupation of Palestinian life there, and to learn about the ways that the U.S. was complicit in this acts of violence, with including military aid to assist the State of Israel in its assault on Palestinian life.
So how did that translate into going? I mean, from learning and hearing about things to making that kind of life decision to go voluntarily to somewhere that's in that kind of peril. And yeah,
I think I was moved and bereaved by this violence and wanting to do some action to resist this violence. And CPT was an organization that I heard about, and I was also learning about Palestine through this organization. And it was my biggest dream, I think, like 4 years ago, to work with CPT specifically in Palestine, in Al-Khalil, and that dream became a reality about 2 years ago.
Yeah. And so for people listening who might not be fully oriented to this conflict, to this region, can you kind of place us in Al-Khalil, in Hebron, it's also known, just for listeners, what kind of a place are we talking about?
Yeah, Al-Khalil is in the south of the West Bank. It's about an hour drive to Bethlehem, to the south. And Al-Khalil is split into two separate areas. One is called H1 and another is called H2. H1 is an area where Palestinians are living under Palestinian authority, whereas in H2, Palestinians are living under Israeli military law. And the Israeli military has a extensive presence in this part of the city. Sometimes the Israeli military still goes into H1 of Al-Khalil, but H2 is also the only area where Israelis can be settlers in the area of Al-Khalil. So Israeli settlers in this area will live directly by Palestinian homes. And there's some settlements that are nearby in this area, but a lot of violence happens for Palestinians. It includes violence that happens directly from Israeli settlers. That includes rocks being thrown at Palestinian children, Palestinians who've been blinded by bleach being thrown at them from Israeli settlers, their neighbors. It includes Israeli military violence children in the area of H2 and Akhlil experience many arrests. Children as young as 12 years old are arrested by Israeli military. And so I lived and worked in Akhlil to bear witness and to document this violence.
Mm-hmm. And so I was just reading that, I mean, it's been there's a lot of violence and arrest and things like that related to many locations through the West Bank where there is settlement. But this specific city is a bit of a different case in some ways, such that there has been kind of special observation presence for a long time. And I don't know, you can probably clarify this, but I know in February, the kind of international observers were sent away. Is that correct?
Yes.
And that left Christian peacemaker teams and possibly some other organizations doing that work. Can you speak to that a little bit?
Yeah. So there was an organization called Temporary International Presence in Hebron, TIF. They kind of came to fruition after the Oslo Accords, an agreement between Palestinian Authority and the State of Israel. And it was the only monitors who were really allowed by the State of Israel to document violence in the city of Hebron and city of Akhlil. And so TIF was an organization that we worked with, and to the extent that, not extensively, but we did work with them in the event of a child being arrested, and we would immediately notify them and another organization. With TIF being gone, that was one resource that we've lost to document and to have some kind of clout and recognition with the State of Israel and these arrests and acts of violence. The only other organization right now that's with Christian peacemaker teams and documenting violence in the city of Akhlil right now is International Solidarity Movement, ISM.
Mm-hmm. So how that documentation is, I mean, it's kind of fraught, right? I mean, you read stories of people having their materials confiscated when they're attempting to document, having cameras broken, et cetera. How common is that, and why is that?
Mm-hmm. It's fairly common. The justification is, I mean, to prevent eyes, to prevent witness of the violence. I think the way that we and CPT have been affected by this the most is, for example, every Sunday through Thursday, CPT is present in the city of Akhlil to document how many teachers, children, and adults go through military checkpoints on their way to school and work. And we do this to document the restriction of movement Palestinians experience with checkpoints. And when we do this, there are times when Israeli border police who are stationed at these checkpoints come over to CPTers to either move them away or to take their passports and take photographs of these passports. And border police have been sending these images of our passports to Israeli customs. So since September of this last year, seven CPTers have been denied entry into the State of Israel through Israeli customs to get into Palestine. Mm. And that's because of this connection.
Wow. So are the majority of these volunteers Americans and Canadians? That's where the two offices are.
There's a number, yeah. And there's also people who are from Europe and Australia. And there are some team members who are from Palestine.
So basically they're returning home after volunteering and having had their passport photographed, and then they're being denied re-entry.
Yes.
When they return. And my impression, and this is the impression I received during my time going to the West Bank in Israel, is that the presence of foreign folks, particularly from, you know, the U.S. and Europe, can be a protective layer to some extent because of the function of our empire, you know, and the eyes on the ground. How does that play out? How does that power dynamic play out in this specific work?
Yeah, I think the ways that we see our power work is sometimes to have that ability to document and to witness and to have a platform to send our documentation to. I think it's notable that a lot of foreigners, when they read about what's happening in Palestine, a lot of their information comes from organizations that are in the U.S. or even Israeli organizations. Very rarely do foreigners listen to Palestinian organizations or Palestinians themselves with the violence that they experience. So hopefully the stories that CPT publishes can be stories that bear witness and are at the invitation of communities. Some of these stories include, I think of a couple of potters who are in the city of Al-Khalil, Nader and Nassar, shopkeepers there. And there was, when I was last there in January, there was a military checkpoint built in front of their shop, preventing any local business from coming to their shop. And in addition to experiencing this violence, there's Israeli settlers nearby their shop who have broken doors of the shop, broken tables of this shop during the first Intifada. And they've even offered the Nader and Nassar and their families $7 million to displace them and to expand settlements in Al-Khalil. They said no to this offer. And I think their no holds incredible power. And we met with them and they asked us to share the story. And I think that there, hopefully there's some power and hopefully some intentionality and recognition within that.
Mm-hmm. Because, I mean, I think the power of people telling their own stories, and obviously, you know, you're here bearing witness to people's stories because it's easier to access, you know, you, and also I think it's important to have a perspective of someone who is from the outside and who also is from a country like the U.S. who's funding the Israeli military to such a large extent. But what do you think the value is, especially in that case, of people telling their own stories?
It's powerful. I mean, that is where the power is at. And I really do hope that people see that. Mm-hmm. Because, like, for example, I think of one of my friends, Abdullah. He once said to me, "We're not victims." It's important for people to see that we're not victims. And within that, Abdullah, these shopkeepers, Nader and Nassar, they hold so much power. And their stories are beautiful. And it's an honor to hear their stories. And that's all that needs to be heard. That's all that needs to be said.
Mm-hmm. And instead, I mean, when he says we're not victims, I think he's obviously saying that in response to the fact that that is the way that Palestinian people are framed at best, in mainstream media. So, where are some of the places that you think people can get access to more three-dimensional information and more direct information about what's going on?
I think it's really difficult. Because I think there's such an emphasis on portraying Palestinians as victims, even if it's that information is sympathetic to what they are experiencing. I think one organization that I really admire in how it has done documentation is an organization called Betzalem. It's in Israel, and it's Israeli and Palestinian, and it is a project that has supplied Palestinians with cameras to document the violence they experience. And that documentation is translated both in Hebrew and Arabic. And I think that's so much more powerful that they are able to document, and meeting activists who are part of this movement. It's an incredible experience to meet them.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, obviously, I think a lot of people have a barrier to engaging with this specific issue, this specific conflict, because it's constantly presented as being very uniquely complicated. And it is uniquely complicated in a lot of ways. But I don't know, what's your take on that and boiling down some of that complexity into simple ways to communicate about this conflict? Because I'm sure people have asked you in your life, people here when you come back home to Washington State, they say, "Well, why were you doing that? And what's it all about?"
Yeah.
What's your short answer that you give people?
Yeah. I think it is a story of colonialism, in that what Palestinians have been displaced from their homes and land that they've been present with and lived on for many years. And State of Israel, when it was founded, displaced Palestinian life. And Palestinians are living in the West Bank, Gaza, East Jerusalem, and inside Israel itself. And this colonialism manifests in many ways, I think, this overt state violence. It's in the city of Al-Khalil. I think one notable example of this was this last year in the month of November, CPT was invited by schools, elementary schools and high schools in the area, to document an escalation of military violence. And we documented that the Israeli military fired 238 rounds of tear gas and 51 rounds of sound grenades directly at Palestinian children, teachers, and inside of schools. So this is Palestinians living under Israeli military rule. That's inside of the West Bank. This includes Palestinians who are living in Israel. I think of the village of Al-Erekib, and it's a village that, even though they're citizens of Israel, this last week, their village has been demolished for the 142nd time since 2010. It's practically every week that there's demolitions for their village. And so there's this story of state violence and they're experiencing throughout the country and in these areas.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's something that people don't know. Maybe they find out when there's an election in Israel, like last week. Yeah. But something like between 15 and 20% of Israel's citizens are Palestinian. And then there are also Palestinian non-citizens living in both the West Bank and Gaza. And then there's also a diaspora of refugees living throughout the world, but, mm-hmm. you know, concentrated in Egypt and Jordan and other places. So just to disambiguate that for everyone, how does that question of citizenship and governance and power play out in Al-Khalil, and how can that support or complicate matters for people?
Yeah. In the city of Al-Khalil, Palestinians live under Israeli military law. Israeli settlers in the area live under Israeli civilian law. So even though they're living in Palestine, they're still living under the law of the State of Israel. And this manifests particularly in the arrest and detention of children in the area. So there's a great campaign called No Way to Treat a Child campaign, and it's brought awareness to the reality that Palestinian children living in the West Bank, and I've seen this in Al-Khalil, where hundreds of Palestinian children are arrested a year and brought to military courts. And in their experience, many of them are presented with a confession in Hebrew, a confession that claims that the child threw stones. And whether or not the child threw stones, it's putting pressure on the child to sign this. And they are taken away from their family without the presence of the parents even knowing where the child's at, and without the presence of a lawyer. And there's many children, Palestinian children, who are incarcerated. And that's all under Israeli military law. Another way that this manifests within military law, I think of a military order called Military Order 101. And it's a law that mandates that Palestinians cannot demonstrate. They can't even use a flag, their own Palestinian flag, without the permit of the Israeli military. And there's that disproportion, mm-hmm. of an inequality what they experience.
So that's, I don't know, I think that's one of many things that people don't fully comprehend just around day-to-day life. I guess to go back to the election, kind of looking at the long haul, you know, Netanyahu's reelected for the fifth time. The whole campaign, I didn't follow super closely, but I know the general gist was that the campaigns were very, were both and all, you know, throughout the Knesset and the prime minister election, really violent, really full of violent imagery and kind of a lot of this, like, we'll keep being quote unquote tough. You know, it's language that we hear too, in the US around immigration. Though it's a different context. And Netanyahu's communicated a desire to formally annex the West Bank. Can you talk a little bit and explain to people just in a practical sense how the settlement process and annexation are related? It's kind of a big question, but yeah.
Definitely. So what I've witnessed, at least in the city of Al-Khalil, is some of the ways that I've witnessed settlements developed was even Israelis moving into Palestinian homes. There was a home called Abu Rajab home. Palestinians were still living in this home, even though that was the experience. Israeli settlers moved in and took the majority of the home. Shortly thereafter, an Israeli military checkpoint was created outside of the house where Israeli border police were stationed 24/7. And so this is a trend that normally happens within settlements as they are established in the West Bank, is settlers come to a part of Palestinian land and assert that they have the legitimacy to be there. And then shortly thereafter, the Israeli military comes to legitimize their presence, and checkpoints are created, and settlements expand. And there's different ways that expansion happens. Sometimes that's settlements that are like a suburb, essentially. There's a settlement that has thousands of people in Al-Khalil called Kiryat Arba. But then in the Palestinian neighborhood of Tel Rameda, Israeli settlers are moving in and living side by side and attacking Palestinians who are their neighbors. In regards to the annexation process that the State of Israel and what Netanyahu is referring to, I would say that from what I've witnessed in the city of Al-Khalil is this annexation is already a reality of whether or not Netanyahu says that in media. It is treated as if it is part of Israel in the sense that the Israeli military is there to legitimize the settlers' presence. And it's a distressing reality.
Mm-hmm. And there are a lot of good, I'll try to find a good recent link for this. There's a lot of great maps that show, like, here are the lines, here are the quote unquote borders, but then here's some shading of where there's an ongoing military presence, of where there's checkpoints. And I think that can really help people to visualize what daily life would be like if you were trying to travel, even minimally, as a Palestinian, particularly as a Palestinian non-citizen. I think it's hard for people to envision when we just hear about, like, oh, there's kind of these three places. And
yeah. Totally.
Yeah. So if you're just joining us, I'm talking with a recently returned volunteer for Christian Peacemaker teams working in the West Bank in Palestine. Talking about that work of witness. So if you missed any part of the beginning of the show, or if you're going to miss part of the end, you can catch the podcast. I'll post it later today. You can find that link on KYRS.org by going to shows Praxis or by going directly to soundcloud.com/PraxisRadio, PraxisRadio. So I kind of want to circle back to that idea of witness. It's a term that's been used politically for a very long time. I don't know the full history of it. I know folks who were involved in doing that in Central American solidarity work through the 80s. What is this concept of witness to you?
I think for me, at least, the intention within CPT, Christian Peacemaker teams, is to work at the invitation of communities and to be invited. It's always at the invitation, I hope, of communities to hear their stories and to bear witness. And I think that witness entails being present and always working at the invitation of people. And with that invitation, what does the community want that witness to look like, and where do they want that to go to? So in regards to documentation, what does a community want the documentation to look like? Where should the documentation go? And so for me, that's what it means to me, is it's mutuality, and it's connection and a relationship. And hopefully that's what we can do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because there, the history of what you said about it being fundamentally a colonial struggle, and then our own U.S. empire being tangled up in that colonial struggle. There's a lot of ways for it to go wrong to even people, I think. And I've seen this in many ways and experienced this and had this conversation with people around Israel and Palestine. There's ways that are problematic to engage and to go in with your own agenda and to say, you know, and even when I returned from doing some activist work and some witnessing work and some journalism based exploration there, a lot of people, I came back and a lot of people wanted to know like what my plan was to quote unquote fix, you know, the Middle East. Like what's my plan, and you know, one state, two state. And right. Have you experienced that as
yes.
well?
Yes, definitely.
What do you tell people when they want to know your grand vision?
For myself, I try to direct the gaze to people, mm-hmm. people who are Palestinian. Because I think our work of witness and activism should always be at the request of communities who's experiencing violence and oppression. And really, they know what's best. I don't.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And what... There's an obvious answer, but I'm curious if there are other answers I haven't thought of here. What do people mostly want who speak to you there?
Yeah. The biggest invitation and request to activists around the world is to join the boycott, divestment, sanction movement. That includes the boycotting of companies and organizations that benefit off of the Israeli military occupation. That includes companies such as Caterpillar, which provides bulldozers to the State of Israel and demolishing Palestinian homes in the West Bank, in East Jerusalem, and inside of Israel as well. And includes organizations like Hewlett Packard, HP, which provides technology for the State of Israel to maintain its military checkpoints and across the West Bank. That's really the largest invitation to the activist community.
Yeah.
That I've encountered.
Mm-hmm. And what do you think? So it's a tricky time here in the U.S. because we've had anti-BDS legislation on the table. Things appear to be shifting somewhat, but even a tiny shift is not much of a shift in terms of the appropriateness, I suppose, of publicly criticizing Israeli policy. You know, we've seen backlash against Congress people and also individual activists who do want to participate in that. So what do you think that we can do? I mean, back to, you know, we're sitting here in the U.S. What do you think our long game is in terms of supporting that request from folks, to whether it's the boycott or whether it's other political action we're being asked to take?
Yeah. I think one thing is resisting some of the structures within the U.S. I mean, that includes laws, anti-BDS laws. And I think of like the Intercept article and coverage of the experience of Bahawi Amawe, a language pathologist in the state of Texas, Palestinian activist. Well, she didn't consider herself an activist, a language pathologist, but in this mm-hmm. experience was kicked out of her role as a teacher fired for not signing a part of a contract within her school that was about whether or not she would ever support BDS. And so she refused to sign this contract or that agreement. And so I think within the US, I think we need to be resisting these structures. There's so much power that can be done within this. This can be done in with organizing within our spaces of worship, within spaces of education. Mm-hmm. These are great places to start.
Mm-hmm. And actually, you know, you and I were talking before, and I think a huge part of the leadership that's coming from the U.S. in terms of solidarity is coming from like mainline Christian churches,
right.
And also like Jewish American activist groups, like Jewish Voice for Peace and others. So, what would you say are ways that people can tap into that or just learn more if they're hearing this for the first time? They're a little bit like, maybe there's things I don't know. What do you think are some good like gateway places to learn a little bit more?
Yeah, I think that there's some great organizations to follow. I think like as far as when it comes to news within the U.S., I think Democracy Now! Has been very consistent in providing analysis and reflection on what Palestinians are experiencing. I think of like B'Tselem, that organization that's providing documentation to what Palestinians are experiencing. And think of Jewish Voice for Peace. Jewish Voice for Peace is doing a wonderful campaign called The Deadly Exchange, bringing awareness to the reality that police departments across the U.S. are sending their officers to Israel to be trained by the Israeli military. And some of these policies that they're being trained with are policies such as racial profiling. So they bring these policies back to the U.S. and conduct racial profiling on people of color, policies that Palestinians experience in the West Bank and Israel, East Jerusalem. And I think those are some good organizations.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that's a good focus, too, for people in the U.S. to think about, like, where, I mean, I'm sure that this happened to me, and I'm sure you could look those 250, however many rounds of tear gas that were shot at school children just in Al-Khalil were probably manufactured in the U.S. I know that the majority of them are.
Yes.
And there was a huge spike in really visual and like open solidarity activism in Ferguson when the protests there were happening, and people were making the connection and posting on social media pictures of, you know, kids in Ferguson and kids in the West Bank holding up matching tear gas canisters.
Totally.
It was super powerful. So,
very powerful.
Yeah. What else was I going to ask you? We're running out of time already. I don't know. What is there anything else that you want to share? Like an impactful story you want to share or, yeah.
I think of, so when I think of Palestine, I think of my friends and I think of the honor it was to hear their stories. And I think, it's important for us to be aware of the power that people hold there. And also just to hear their stories. And so like one story I remember right now is I remember being in the balcony of one of my friend's homes. His name is Mo, and we were hanging out and he was speaking to me about the reality of checkpoints, and he said to me, "I wish we could go to the sea. The sea should be free." And it's bereaving that Palestinian movement, Palestinian life is restricted across the West Bank, East Jerusalem, Israel, and Gaza. And I hope that people feel moved to act and to share what they hear and stories that they learn.
Great. Well, thank you so much for talking with me. I'll be posting links to the organizations and articles and stuff that you shared. If you think of anything else, send it to me and I will include it by tonight. So
thank you so much, Taylor, for your work at Witness.
Yeah. Thank you. So if you're just joining us at the end of this chunk of the show, I've been talking with a recently returned volunteer from Christian Peacemaker teams working in the occupied West Bank, working in Palestine. If you missed any part of that, I will be posting the podcast tonight. I'm going to take a quick break, and then I'll be back on the phone talking about the Spokane chapter of the NAACP's 100-year celebration, which is later today. So stay tuned, and I'll be right back. You're listening to Praxis on KYRS Thin Air Community Radio. I'm on the phone with Curtis Robinson. Can you hear me out there, Curtis?
Yeah, I sure can.
Awesome. Thanks so much for joining me by phone. Curtis is the president of the Spokane chapter of the NAACP. Happy birthday.
All right. Happy birthday, Spokane NAACP, right?
Yes. So do you want to talk about that a little bit? I had no idea until I read the announcement, embarrassingly, that the chapter was 100 years old.
Oh, my gosh. No worries. Yeah. You know, I mean, it's really it's a historic event. It's an auspicious occasion. We were so grateful to have the mayor and the city council acknowledge this special day by making April the official Spokane NAACP Centennial Month. So, it's just a big deal for us. We've had a dog in the fight for a long time on the back of, by the tireless efforts of some local icons, Carl Max, the Ann Smith, the founder, I believe it's trying to pronounce his name without killing it. I want to say it's Emmett Reed. James Chase, just to name a few. So it's been a great thing that's happened here for our local community, and I think the most outstanding thing about all of it is about where we're at as far as the issues that they were fighting for and how far we still have to go.
Mm-hmm. And so what have you all learned, I guess, about that history in moving toward the centennial? I mean, obviously, racism is the issue then and now. But what were some of those specific issues like back in 1919 versus today?
Well, how do you even begin to articulate that? I mean, Kayla, we just don't have enough time to talk about what those issues were. But the reality is that the things that we're fighting about, they were. They were things at a much lower level as far as the work, and the progress that's been made. It's still the same fight at the core, but, if you could imagine being in the early 1900s, just coming out of slavery, all those things, the fact that this was native land, natives were still actively in masses being killed here. You've got a church that's just getting off the ground, trying to just to even have the right to exist, let alone come together and congregate, as far as communities of color. There's so many things that were going on at that time. It's like, just to even imagine what it must have been like, the courage, the fortitude, the drive, the will, and the hope that this organization had and these people had. To even fathom doing such a thing, let alone actually accomplish it, is just staggering.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And what do you think, where do you see, as someone who is leading in this organization, but also just as a person of color in Spokane, Washington, where do you see that legacy living now?
Well, I see that... as many of the advancements that have been made, you'll have to excuse me if you're hearing shuffling stuff like that because I'm on my way out the door. where we're at now is, the reality is that we got here on the blood, sweat, tears, heartache, scars of, the people that, started this fight here and started this fight in our nation. And, where we're at right now is a place to where, we have not made as much progress as we should have by this time. And that's just the real. And everything across the board from economic justice to, racial equity, let alone just even the concept of equality, but let's talk about equity, right?
Mm-hmm.
The criminal justice thing, we are just, we're getting slammed. In some of the recent cases that, have been spotlighted, really kind of exemplify that, our persons of color, our Native Americans, our African American brothers and sisters, we're 5 to 7 times more likely across the board to encounter things, everything from initial contact in the police force, use of force contact, everything in from, being incarcerated, spending time in incarceration, bail amount for pretrial services. It's just everything, including all the way wrapping it back around into the entry. And then the struggle that our people have for finding meaning, depth, and, success. Once they've actually experienced that, we're just not where we should be. And I think, you know, that's what's really on the table right now, is we have a lot of hope, we have a lot of drive, we have a lot of will. We have a right to have that because we've got a lot of great people that have brought it to this point, but we have got a long ways to go.
Mm-hmm. And so what are some, for people who aren't involved and who maybe don't even know that Spokane has an active chapter of the NAACP, what are you guys primarily working on right now that people might be able to get involved in and support one way or another?
Well, you know, we're definitely involved in, you know, addressing the school-to-prison pipeline, you know, dealing with the CRO issues, dealing with the disparities in school discipline. You know, we're highly engaged in not only that, but also the criminal justice system as far as addressing the issues about them wanting to build a new jail after we're already disparately represented within that system. And we've had the 8 deaths in the 14 months in the county jail, 6 deaths in, or 5 deaths in the 6 months prior to that, as well as the Justice Department audit that found Spokane to be one of the top worst criminal justice systems in the United States, and our persons of color are disproportionately represented within that system. So there's a lot of places to get involved. We're next month we're going to have a general meeting, which will be in the community building in downtown Spokane. Will be the feature will be environmental issues.
Mm.
And so we're going to have hopefully Deb Abrahamson there, 350 Spokane, as well as the Riverkeepers presenting on what the challenges are.
Yeah. So talking about environmental justice, hopefully in the ways that climate change and the environment all impact people of color disproportionately, again, like you were saying about criminal justice.
Yeah, right. I mean, that's what's up, because, I mean, you know, the bottom line is we've been, you know, because I don't have any other words right this minute, we've been the low-hanging fruit on the economic chain, right?
Mm-hmm.
And people of economic means and generational privilege have benefited time and time again from that status when it comes to environmental issues, exposure to places that have a history of toxicity. And, you know, when you look around that, so not only clean air, you know, issues, but, you know, just general ground toxicity, it's communities of color. You know, it's the poor, it's the impoverished, it's the ostracized that are living there, whereas the rest of society, the privileged, the benefited, the generationally benefited, you know, are the ones that are the furthest away from that. And so when it comes to actually addressing these issues, the voice that we're fighting for is that those closest to the problem are closest to the solution.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the voice that we're really fighting for in these spaces.
Yeah, it's exactly what we just talked about for an hour with my guest. Closest right, people to the problem know the solution. So yeah. If people want to come out tonight and celebrate with you all and get engaged, what's going on this evening?
So we're having the we are the month of the NAACP, the Spokane Centennial, by ordinance of the mayor and city council, and so that ordinance will be read at Calvary Baptist Church at Third Avenue, just across the street from Goodwill. It's in that upper downtown area, and I do not have the exact address right in front of me, but if you look up Calvary Baptist Church, 3rd Avenue, there's only one, and there's only one Goodwill on 3rd Avenue, and they're just right there. You can't miss it.
It's at 203 East 3rd.
Is that the one? I'm gonna take your word on that.
Yep. We're taking Google's word. So sorry, it's at 6 o'clock.
Say again?
So you were saying it's at 6 o'clock tonight?
Yeah, starts at 6 o'clock from 6 to 8 p.m. It's totally okay to come in whenever you can, because many people are going to be kind of bouncing in and out a little late. You know, everybody's got a lot of schedules and stuff, but it should be a great event. Keontha Duncan from Empire Health and our newest member at large and a writer for the Black Lens is going to be our keynote speaker, but Power to the Poetry will be there. Gloria Choa Brooke is going to read the proclamation from the mayor. James Wilburn, previous president, will be there as well, making a little bit of Africana statement, as well as talking about our youth and what's coming up with the the Freedom Fund banquet event where we do the oh my gosh, the guys, the name is killing me. I've been talking about it so long, it's like it's gone.
Mm-hmm.
But it'll be, you know, he'll be talking about the scholarship that the NAACP sponsors year in, year out. So,
well, great. So tonight.
Tonight, 6 p.m.
Tonight's the night. Well, thanks for making some time to talk to me. Do you have any just like last statement you want to leave our listeners with?
No, I think, you know, I think we've pretty much said it all. I'm just looking forward to moving into the next century with this group of people that we've got surrounding us. And hopefully the call out and this kind of celebration will bring more attention to the issues that are already on the table and more galvanizing to moving it forward to where we all know it needs to be, because when we all do better, we all do better.
Perfect. All right. Well, thank you so much for talking with me, and hopefully I will see you later tonight.
Okay, Taylor. Thank you.
All right. All right. So that was Curtis Robinson, president of the Spokane chapter of the NAACP, by phone. Getting ready for their centennial celebration tonight. You can find more information about them at SpokaneNAACP.com and .org. I want to say it's at both. So their event tonight is at 203 East 3rd Calvary Baptist from 6 to 8. Earlier in the hour, I was talking with a recently returned volunteer who I met, who was working with Christian Peacemaker teams in Palestine. If you missed any part of that interview and you want to hear it, you can find the whole show on the podcast in just a couple hours. It will go on. You can find it on iTunes, Google Play, anywhere that you get your podcasts, or you can go directly to soundcloud.com/PraxisRadio, PraxisRadio. I will be back next week with another show. Just a quick plug from last week. If you missed the interview with David Barsamian, who will be joining us to benefit KYRS tomorrow night at the Unitarian Church, you can also find that online, and you still have enough time to be inspired by his interview and grab a ticket. So until next time, thanks for listening. I was one.